I'm Kimberly Anderson. Welcome to the Sunstone Firesides Podcast. We are in Oakland, California with Mehdi Harrison. Hi, Mehdi.
Hi. Good to be here.
No, it's good to be here with you. I'm visiting you in your daughter's home.
True, but I am also visiting in my daughter's home, so somehow we are both happy to see each other.
Well, clearly we are. Oh, so many people will come to this podcast and not know who I am, and they won't know who you are. What do we need to know about you if we're coming at you cold? We don't know Mehdi.
Okay, so these are some things that I actually put in my introduction to my memoir now. I went to BYU and graduated with a bachelor's and a master's in 2 years after I finished high school. Then I got a full ride scholarship to Princeton for a PhD program in German. And I finished that program when I was 24. I was the first person in my class to graduate. So I had a PhD at age 24 and then taught at BYU for a few years and decided to become a writer. So now I'm better known for my young adult novels, including Mirror, Mirror, and The Princess and the Hound. And now I'm writing the mystery series, starting with The Bishop's Wife.
Tell me about your bachelor's degree, your master's degree, and your PhD work. Did that have any foundational bearing on what you're doing now as a writer, or were they completely separate and unrelated?
Okay, so that is a good question, and it's something I ask myself a lot. Tangentially related, I would say. So I lived in Germany my sophomore year in high school and learned to speak fluent German. I went to a German gymnasium and took classes in physics and biology and chemistry in German, and took English in German also, which was interesting.
Okay, wait a minute. You studied, you're a native English speaker.
Yes.
Studying English.
Yes.
In the German school system.
Yes.
In German.
And I got graded on it also. And sometimes I got things wrong.
Oh, goodness gracious. Huh, I love language.
If I had another life to live, I would be a linguist and I would study languages. I love languages. I love German in a special way. And I tell people sometimes that I had to study German because there's a darkness and depression in German literature that comes out in my writing. And I've had people say to me, like, somehow your work feels different than other people who are writing in English in America today. And I think that that might be related to the fact that I did not read in college the books that other people read.
You're reading Kant.
I read Kant and Faust
right.
And Hermann Hesse and, yeah.
And what were your musicians you were listening to?
I am not a music person. I do not listen to music still to this day.
Really? You enjoy silence? Podcasts? Written?
Oh, podcasts I'll listen to.
Okay.
But so if I'm running, I will have an audiobook or a podcast on. But while I'm actually writing a novel, I can't listen to it. I don't understand how anybody can listen to anything while they are writing a novel. I have to have earplugs in. It might be one of the reasons why I write so quickly, but I have such deep attention and focus that my kids will come in and I won't even notice that they're there. They'll have to shake me to get me to pay attention.
I will say this, that on the days that you announce your word count, your page count, I am sitting there looking at that laptop screen and I'm thinking to myself, it's unbelievable. You are churning out the words. I mean, you're a writer, clearly. That's what you do.
Yes.
But and I don't understand how writing works. I mean, I consider myself a bit of a writer. I'm not a writer. I'm an artist and becoming other things now. I understand the writing process for me is tedious. And when I say tedious, it's tedious amount of procrastination and then a mad flurry of kind of this giant spark of creativity and desperation wrapped up in rough editing and poor formatting. That's my writing style.
But if you could channel that, you know, burst and do it 8 hours a day, you might end up with the kind of word count that I've got. And I don't do that kind of word count every day. It's feast or famine for me. There are times when I'm not writing anything new at all, where I'm gestating ideas or editing or, but yeah, there are days I think I hit 12,000, which is my all-time high at some time this year. That's 8 hours of editing. I mean, 8 hours of first drafting. And they're very messy. And I have no I have no pride in my writing. I'm not precious with my words, so I'll just vomit. And I'm very good at, I tell people, I think it's a useful skill to have an editor hat and a writer hat. And you don't put them on at the same time.
Oh, I can't. No, they're both on all the time for me.
Yeah, that's a really not a useful way to write.
So I've learned.
Yeah, so if you can take off the editor hat and just have your writer hat on, then you don't have to listen to the editor saying things like, that's not a good sentence. So I'm just plowing through, and then I'll take off my writer hat and put on my editor hat back again. And that's useful because then my writer person doesn't get their feelings hurt because they're all done.
You're gentle with that writer person.
Yes, I really am. And I believe that that's one of the reasons why I've had a really long career as a writer, because that creative self is very tender and it needs to be coaxed gently. You can't pressure it. The other thing I've learned is, over the years, I have stopped trying to write things that are marketable. Well, for many years, I would go around and tell other writers, you have lots of ideas, so just pick the idea that's more marketable. Talk to your agent and like talk about what's hot in the market and just pick that idea, and then you can pour your energy into that idea. That is not the way that my creative self works anymore. Now, what happens is I wake up in the morning and I feel like the universe is calling to me and telling me what to write. And it doesn't matter whether that is marketable or not, but because if I tell the universe, no, that idea is not marketable, I'm gonna like send me some better ideas, then the universe stops sending me ideas. So,
one of the challenges I like to give my students when I taught photography, I'd say, what project do you want to work on that you're never going to get paid for,
yeah,
that no one's ever going to see,
yes,
that you're going to finish and it's going to be really polished and put together and done, and you're going to put it under your bed, mm-hmm, and no one's ever going to look at it. Mm-hmm. What's that project going to be?
That's a really good question. When I wrote The Bishop's Wife, it came out of me sitting down with my agent and I was about to fire him. And we sat down and had this conversation. It was, I call it the come to Jesus moment that we had. And I gave him a list of projects that I was interested in working on, a list of 10 things. And I said, you pick one, I'll write it and send it to you. And if we can work on it together, then I won't fire you. And he looked down the list, and I think number 9 on the list was The Bishop's Wife. And he pointed at that and he said, well, whatever you do, don't write that one.
So of course.
Which is such a funny story. It was the best thing that he could have said to me. It's so weird because...
Moth to a flame?
Well, I don't think it was just me being obstinate, although maybe there was some of that. I think there was also... It was a gift. Like he said to me, after he said, don't write that, he said, nobody cares about Mormonism. Nobody will ever be interested in buying that. And that was such a gift to me because what it said to me was, this is a safe thing for you to work on. You can do whatever you want. You can tackle scary stuff here because no one will ever read it. We'll never sell. I mean, it did turn out selling, and then I spent 2 years in utter terror. I wrote it in a 3-week time period. I sent
it off to an editor. You wrote that book in 3 weeks.
Yeah. And then I sold it in like 3 weeks after that, to an editor who I'd never thought would buy it, who she was just a friend of mine, and I thought she was going to give me advice. And then I had to wait for almost 2 full years before it came out, and I was terrified that everyone I had ever met would hate me for writing that book.
And has that happened? Does yes. everybody hate you?
Almost everybody that I knew at that time will no longer speak to me. Yes.
So it is true. Your deepest, darkest fears
yes.
realized.
Yes, they did come true.
If you knew that was going to happen, would you have still written the book?
I don't know. Mm. I told my editor at the time that whatever was going to come, I was fine with. But I also really didn't believe that this would happen. So
was it kind of pedal to the metal? You're talking 3 weeks to write a book.
Yeah.
Was that writing and editing? Did you go back and polish, or did you just kind of...
I really didn't edit. I really sent off a first draft, and I do not recommend doing that. But because my agent had told me it would never sell, I was just...
It didn't matter.
I didn't care. Again, it was a beautiful space to be in where I could just write whatever I wanted. And as I said, I sent it to an editor friend, not somebody I thought was going to buy it. I just wanted her basic idea of like she thought maybe somebody in a national market might be interested in a Mormon. If she'd said no, I would have put it in a trunk. Nobody would ever have seen it again.
What about that book was so controversial that none of those people then will speak to you now?
So maybe it's not fair to say it's just the book because my dear Mormon book group read that book. And as far as I can tell, they didn't hate it. But writing that book set me on a path that led to most of my relationships being ended, or at least so dramatically changed. Because what happened was, after I wrote the book, so it came out in late December 2014, and mid 2015, I got an offer from Huffington to write about Mormonism for them. And then I started writing every week about Mormonism, and I wrote
prolifically.
Those were the things that got me in trouble with people. At first, I started posting them on Facebook, and I was Facebook friends with everybody in my ward. And then I started realizing they don't like this, and I unfriended them. The first essay that I wrote, that I had that trembling, like sick to my stomach terror of like, what have I done, was, I think the title of it is Mormonism and White Supremacy. And it was the very day of the Charlottesville shooting.
I sat down
at my computer, and this was one of those moments where the universe was like, you must write about this, because I ended up feeling like we are complicit in white supremacy.
As Mormons.
And I felt like I had to own that. And writing this essay, like, I can't ignore the fact that this is our problem too. And so I sat down and wrote this essay, and I that is the essay that I worked on the hardest. I read it over and over and over again before I hit submit. And it was the fastest published essay. I think it was up within 15 minutes of me hitting submit. I've been working for the last several months on reworking my memoir about my daughter Mercy's stillbirth in 2005, which at the time, I set out very consciously to work on this memoir, and it was going to be a one-year grief journal. And my idea when I started it was, I was going to show people how you grieve, and then I was going to be finished grieving at the end of a year.
Oh, how did that work, Mr. Formula, or Miss Little Miss Formula?
Well, I'm reading through this journal, and there are parts of it where I'm like, that is what really happened. And then there are other parts where I'm like, old Metty. I'm having a conversation with old Metty and new Metty. That's how I describe it, even though I'm aware that I am on some level the same person. But she lies some of the time, because maybe lying is the wrong word. She desperately wanted to have this narrative of the person who was going to get over her grief and pain. And then she wanted to be her old self again. She wanted not to have changed. And so that was the narrative she was writing the entire year. And there are bits of the reality of her realizing, wait a minute, it feels like I'm completely changed. And then she cuts back and says, oh no, I'm going to get better. I just read today the very last entry that she wrote, which was a year and one day after Mercy's death. And the last entry is something like, I think I'm recovered now. Everything's fine. And I read that today and just thought, how could you even have written that? It was such a betrayal of the experience that I had been through, which was, it changed me so dramatically. And one of the main things that I see about old Metty is her refusal to recognize her pain. Over and over and over again in the journal, she'll write something like, today, I woke up, I had terrible insomnia, I couldn't sleep all night because I had these intrusive thoughts of all how sad I was. But instead of like thinking to herself, I should get some therapy, or maybe I need to like, she just shoved it down, woke up the next day, and decided to put on this mask of, I'm a perfect Mormon woman, I'm going to be a good example. And indeed, everybody around me said to me all the time, you are such a good example. I can't believe that you're back doing this so soon after you lost your daughter.
And what stage of the grief cycle were you stuck in right there?
Well, I cycled around, but yeah, denial was definitely a large part of it. I mean, one of the things that I kept cycling through is if only, which I now recognize is
bargaining.
No, I think it's denial, because I kept thinking in my head of like what would have happened if she hadn't died. Mm-hmm. Like I wanted to have this other life instead of the one that I actually had, which is why I think of it as denial. I wanted to go down this other path that wasn't my life instead of having the life that I had. So I spent all this time not acknowledging my own pain, mm-hmm. and it doesn't work. It didn't work. And the whole idea...
What led you to know and understand that that doesn't work? That you have to confront your pain?
I don't know if there was a moment. Like, literally, it feels like it took me 15 years to look back at this grief journal and finally realize, for one thing, why it was never published. Because I couldn't tell the truth. I couldn't acknowledge my own pain. It's taken a long time for me to realize I have these really unhealthy habits of shoving down the pain and trying to make myself do stuff instead of listening. And all through the journal, there are these cues of like, oh, today I just felt like I was sick all day or nauseated, or the day after Mercy died, I threw up over and over and over again. Grief was this physical experience for me, but I couldn't see it or talk about it in any meaningful way. It was just, I'm supposed to be not grieving anymore.
So has this been hanging around for 15 years?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have the original document that I wrote from 2005 to 2006 on my laptop. And then I have an edited version that I wrote in 2007, which I sent out to an agent, and another version in 2013, which I sent out. It was really interesting to me. So I thought, oh, I should read the 2013 one, which is the most recent one. But as I was reading it, I realized, what about this entry that I'm sure I wrote about? And I'd just taken it out. I had to go back to the original draft. And then today, as I was poking around in my computer, this file came up. You can call this a tender mercy if you want. But this file came up on my computer that I had under this directory that I didn't know existed. And it was other things that I had excised, even from the original text, that I didn't want to acknowledge as I was writing that story. But there are parts. So I'm now trying to create this narrative of here's what really happened. But obviously you can't do that because I am not that same person. I'm only me now. But at least I can have this weird conversation with, this is what I think she was trying to do. And this is why I think she was trying to do that. But yeah, I'm aghast now at the idea that I was going to be done with grieving in 1 year. I was going to show people how it was done.
How long did it take you?
It's never going to be done.
and isn't that an important thing to acknowledge, that this grief will continue to cycle through us?
But I think there are people around me who are angry when I say that. They just feel like, oh, well, you didn't grieve properly. And I have stopped arguing with them about it. You know, I've just sort of said, you know, you can have your own way of dealing with pain, and I'm going to have mine.
Because ultimately, isn't that what it has to be? My way of grieving can never be expected to be your way of grieving. A, we're different people. B, the thing that we're grieving over are completely different things, even if it's the same thing.
It is so odd, but yeah. You are right. But I think we started talking about pain, but for me, what my whole project in life to avoid pain... turned out to not really be a very useful project. So the idea that we would spend our lives trying to find out the things that would bring us the least pain seems now to me to be a way of actually, if I were to set out to do that, I would say to myself, what you're really doing is trying to not have feelings at all. You're just trying to like say to yourself, I want you to be like this. You're trying to create this mold and stuff your body into it, and then treat yourself like a little robot puppet or something that like move around in the world instead of actually having experiences. And it's still one of my problems today that I have habits that old Mehdi had, like I count all my steps while I run. Mm-hmm. And I do that on purpose to keep my brain busy so I don't think other thoughts.
Ouch, this hurts. Gee, I'm tired. Hey, I'm thirsty. Gotta go to the bathroom.
Those thoughts, but also other deeper thoughts like... how do I feel about Mormonism? And, you know, what am I going to do about my feelings about God? How do I deal with anger?
Reading is weird. It takes up your whole body. You can't walk, you have to hold a book in your hands, and you have to look at words the whole time. That's why you have me. I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. I narrate Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction and poetry for you, so you can do dishes, or rock climb, or drive your Ferrari, or skydive. Whatever it is you like to do while listening to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join the We Do Fun Stuff While Learning About Mormon Stuff Club. I'll see you there.
Yeah, I've started to have this new tagline of, I love Mormonism. I just don't believe in the church. There's just so many things I love about Mormonism. And I'm not gonna throw those things away. I'm just gonna, Mormons don't like me saying this kind of thing any more than ex-Mormons often. I feel like I'm in this middle space. It's really complicated. But I'm not gonna give up my love of the story of Alma or the story of Lehi's dream. Those stories are such great stories. They are instructive. They're massive myths of my life that I build a foundation on. I'm not giving them up, but I don't believe in the church.
Does that hurt to say that?
No, I don't think it does.
Did it a while ago, or would it have hurt a while ago?
Well, if I'd said it a while ago, but I probably wasn't ready to say it for a long time.
That's my point. Yeah. This is a journey that we go on, and then we arrive at a place where we can say something like that and not blink and not stutter and not stammer and not cry. Yeah, this is a journey. I will say this, though. When I moved here to California, I moved to a little tiny town called Isleton. Literally in the middle of nowhere, population 862. And the Mormon church has a branch in the next town over called Rio Vista. And I started attending that branch, not because I believed in Mormonism, not because I had suddenly had a change of heart, but because I missed community.
Yeah.
I missed the people. I missed familiarity.
Yeah.
A Mormon church smells like a Mormon church no matter where you go. And that one in Rio Vista, that little branch building in Rio Vista, smelled like my ward building in Riverton, Utah. So I felt, and still do feel, comfort when I go into a Mormon church.
I'm so glad that you still do that. I am taking a year off because I feel like I need to sort through some things. Mm-hmm. But I love that you still feel like, you know, that's home in some way. I'm sure it's very complicated. But I like that you are admitting to yourself, you're embracing the part of yourself that still loves that, instead of, again, shoving it away and saying, I don't want to be that person anymore. You're just saying, I am that person still.
Well, so here's the thing that I've learned about my life. If I can't show up with 100% authenticity, I can't show up.
Yep. Well, I tried that for a long time.
How did it go for you? Tell us how that went for you, Maddie.
Well, 15 years. And it was a long, slow movement because I think I was kicking and screaming a long time for not wanting to change.
Do you remember who lit the fuse on that?
On the change?
Yeah, that precipitous journey.
Well, I mean, I feel like it was very different for me than almost everybody that I've talked to. Most people who leave Mormonism leave, in my experience, because of social issues like women and the church or LGBT issues, or they leave over historical issues like Joseph Smith's polyandry.
Take your pick, yeah.
Mountain Meadows Massacre, like a lot of different things.
Right.
Neither of those were things that I cared about at the time. What happened to me was when my daughter died, the narratives that people offered me about Mormon God were destructive to my soul. And I'm sure they didn't mean to hurt me. But the thing that I kept swirling around in my head was, this happened to me because I was supposed to learn a lesson. And unfortunately, what that also meant was, if I don't learn the lesson, then this is going to happen to me again. And I was terrified that one of my other children was going to die if I didn't learn a lesson. And so I was in this massive panic to figure out what the lesson was supposed to be. Like,
so are you inventing lessons? Were you searching for lessons?
Yes.
You're fabricating lessons.
Yeah. I mean, and it's all through this journal of mine was trying to figure out, oh, maybe it's this lesson. That, I mean, I can give you some of the examples of bizarre lessons that I thought I was supposed to learn. One of the stories that a friend offered me was that I was supposed to not work anymore.
They derived that story from the loss of your daughter.
Yes.
That you were not supposed to work anymore.
If I didn't work anymore and stayed at home with my kids, which I was a writer. I mostly stayed at home with my kids already. It was just their desperate attempt. I look back on this now and I can see what they were doing. What they were doing was trying to protect themselves. And people are not conscious of this. I don't have a psychology degree or anything, but I just gradually figured out that one of the terrible things about grieving is that in addition to having to deal with your own crap, you have a double burden of dealing with everybody else's crap.
So I will have a degree in psychology in about 3.5 weeks. And I can tell you that you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so they go around, you're grieving, and these people want to, they think in their heads that they're offering you a narrative that's like going to help you. But what they're really doing is offering themselves a narrative to protect themselves from that ever happening to them. So this person who offered me that narrative was somebody who told herself, well, I already stay home with my kids, so obviously God will never take any of my kids. So, and I understand absolutely why people do that. That was one of the things that was most awful about what happened to me was that I realized that I had spent my entire life believing that I had this special protection because I checked off all these lists of things that were Mormon, like, good stuff. And I was better than everybody else because I'm very, very good at following lists. Like, as you've noticed with me and my word count, I am extremely focused when I, like, have a goal in mind. It's why I was able to finish college and a BA and an MA in 2 years.
Two years.
2 years.
2 years. I just want to make sure everyone hears that clearly. 2 years. Two calendar years, two academic years.
Two calendar years.
Okay.
So I had believed that I had this special protection. And then when it was stripped away from me, when I realized the vulnerable place that the world was and that any of my children could die at any moment, it was so terrifying. I have an essay about this called Falling into an Endless Pit. There is no bottom to this pit of fear. Like, everyone that you care about can die at any moment. Anytime I let my kids out of the house, they can die. They could be hit by a car. I remember one of the stories that I talked about in my journal was that my husband took the kids out and built a snow fort for them, and they slept in the snow fort. And I spent 8 hours that night in bed, terrified they were all going to die in the snow fort. Because there's no protection.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How many existential crises do you have in a week?
Well, not very many now.
Okay, old Nettie, how many?
Well, I just feel like I had the same one over and over and over again until I figured out what was going on. Yes. Yes, because my strategy was checklists and shoving it down. And those did not work for many, many years, but it took me a long time to acknowledge that those strategies were not working. And then to figure out some other strategies.
So, this is interesting because we can look at the vast swath of Mormonism, of Mormons, individuals participating in Mormonism, and the checklists and the squashing down does work for a tremendous number of people.
Okay. Somehow it stopped working for me.
Well, it doesn't work for me either. But we do see that there are lots and lots of happy Mormons that are willing to do an endless checklist and to squash down pain and questions.
Hey, I would still be willing to do the checklist.
If only.
I love checklists. I make up my own checklist. My checklist now, ask my kids, just as long. Underneath that was this deep sense that I was unworthy of God's love and that I had to work harder than everybody else on the planet. I had to be number one in everything, otherwise God would never love me.
Can I ask you another question?
Yeah.
Where does guilt and shame show up in your life?
So, I mean, that was part of this eternal circle that I was in after Mercy died. So this lesson of, this idea that you have to learn a lesson, what that said to me was that somehow I wasn't good enough and that I was a bad mother. That was the thing that tore my belief in the old Mormon God away from me, because ultimately when I was finally able to step back and look at what I was saying to myself, I saw that I couldn't believe in a God who would take away an innocent child in order to teach me a lesson. And I understand that that is not like a fair, robust explanation of Mormonism. But that was the cycle that I was caught in my head. And I had to not believe in God for a while after that, because it made me suicidal for a long time. I just needed space to not have any God at all, and to just have random chance. That it may sound strange, but that was the most blessed relief to me. It's like my daughter died out of random chance, had nothing to do with me. And I could, within Mormonism, I couldn't find a way to that narrative. It was always, it's your fault. You're a bad mom. Somehow I was supposed to know that she was in danger. And I did have this spiritual, I'm putting that in quotes. I felt like the night before, I asked my husband to take me to the hospital. I said I felt like something was wrong. And he kept telling me, it's fine. I gave you a blessing. The baby's going to be fine. And I couldn't help but think to myself that that had been a test. God had given me a test and I had failed the test. And that meant that I was a bad mom. And so God was going to keep taking away my children. For a while, I couldn't even pray for my children to be safe, because I kept thinking, this is really crazy, but I kept thinking that even mentioning their names to God would like draw them to his attention, and I needed to protect. So that was why, you asked what the tipping point was. It wasn't me going down any rabbit holes. It was just this deep experience of, this cannot be God. This cannot be God. I cannot worship this person that you are describing to me, who takes away a child to teach a mother a lesson. There is no lesson that I could possibly learn that would not make me say to myself, I wish my daughter was still alive. Like, take me and, that is the job of a mom. And I have a poem I wrote about this. Like, the job of the mom is to stand in front of the truck, to shove the child out of the way and get run over by the train, right? That's your job. And I didn't do that. I failed. And Mormonism made me feel like God had chosen this, not me. And so I couldn't worship that God anymore. I had to have space. And I actually do have belief in God again. It feels like it's a very different God, but there might be Mormons who believe in something like the same kind of God.
Describe your current God, your version of God.
Well, my current version of God is not necessarily an embodied human, and it might just be the universe. Although I do imagine, I have these dream visions, kind of prayer meditation thing that I do at night, and sometimes God appears to me in the form of a woman, a mother. Sometimes as Jesus, sometimes as a child or a tree or a bird. So I don't feel like there's a specific physicality.
Can God be all of those things?
Yes. Or none of them.
Or more of than that.
Yeah. So I feel God is this abundance. And also God is just love. I mean, isn't there a song?
There are many songs about that. Tell me about your cosmology. Where do you sit now with the universe?
Well, I just feel like when I enter the space of God, again, sometimes I walk into a mansion. Sometimes we're on a boat. Most recently, I had this experience where Christ had me walk on water with him. And I had this experience of like walking on water. Or I also had an experience recently where I was sitting on the porch steps outside of the church. And Jesus came down and sat by me and said, like, why don't you go inside? And I'm like, I'm not welcome there anymore. And then we ended up walking through the church, the empty church, after everybody had gone. And I had that experience, like, I think a little bit like what you were talking about, where I saw the things within the church that I love so dearly, but I had to only see them without people around, because I felt like somehow they would interfere with my experience. And that was ultimately, I think, the reason why I have stopped attending, because it was so painful to me to be in a church setting and want to talk about my experiences with God. But when I tried to share these deep spiritual experiences, and the message I got back was, no, that's not how God is. I feel like Mormonism is this. Sometimes they're so focused on teaching people doctrine and making sure that you understand, like, God is this, that they can't listen to other people's spiritual experiences. And that's fine. You can set your own rules for how, but that it just made it so that I didn't feel like my sacred experiences were welcome there. And so I felt like I had to take them elsewhere. A friend of mine posted this, I think, somewhere on social media. They said a tragedy is something that you don't choose, but healing is the parts that you choose after the tragedy happens. And I'm working through that idea in my book and trying to actually think to myself, what did you choose? What are the things that you chose and how have they helped you heal? And to me, writing was one of the things that I chose, and writing has helped me heal.
So that's your cosmology.
A friend of mine told me that she feels like the spirit is a river and that we sometimes dip into it and we take out whatever it happens to be in that spot in the river, but it's not always for us. So I found that to be a really useful metaphor. So sometimes I feel like I'm writing these poems down not for me, but they're a message to somebody else. And so I post them on Facebook, and every once in a while I have somebody say, how did you know? And so maybe it was for them. I don't know. Again, I'm not trying to say that I'm a special person or anything. I'm just, this is a weird experience that I have had with my spiritual journey. But I will say that as I have been reworking this memoir, I have realized finally where those poems go. Mm-hmm. Those poems are the now part of that memoir, me talking to myself about where I am now.
So new Medi.
Yes, new Medi is the one who has the poems, and they help explain my new cosmology and new relationship with God. And my poems almost never have anything to do with anything else. They're all about God. They're boring. Friends who are atheists may find them annoying.
Okay, that's pretty funny. Let's look back at this space where old Medi and new Medi coexist. Was there ever a part in old Medi's existence where she could see new Medi and say, this is my guide?
No, she was terrified of her.
Okay, so she saw new Medi and she ran.
Oh, yes. That was a lot of the journal, is her having the sense of, I have to change. I have to radically re-understand the world. She didn't want to do that. There's a part of me now. This is the other wonderful, beautiful part of this experience, is for me going back and realizing, I love her so much. She was trying so hard. And maybe out of that will also come a way to love my TBM, true believing Mormons, who I feel estranged from right now. Mm. If I can see in them, this woman who told me the story about, if you stayed home from work, then your daughter wouldn't have died. She was scared. She's so scared. And old Medi was so scared. She just wanted security back. She wanted to believe that she had control over the universe and that she could protect her children. Was that such a terrible thing for her?
No, that's your job.
So why am I mad at other people who want that same thing? Can't I just love them in the same way that I'm starting to learn to love old Medi? That's one of my problems.
Is that a rhetorical question, or do you want an answer?
Well, you can give me an answer. I think it was more rhetorical.
I would say the answer is that's a rhetorical question. So new Medi has compassion, grace, understanding, love for old Medi.
Yeah, I didn't know that was going to happen. I thought when I looked back at my journal that I would be so embarrassed.
And instead you found?
I just feel so much compassion for her. Just, she was trying so hard. And she was so scared. How can I feel anything else for her? She spent every minute of every day running around trying so hard to find some new checklist to be really good at.
Do you think there's a version or a space in old Medi that can say thank you to new Medi?
I don't know. I have a poem about new Medi and old Medi sitting across from each other at a table. And in the poem, old Medi knows that new Medi is her old self, but new Medi doesn't know. Old Medi doesn't know that or the older version of herself is there. She thinks it's a different person. In my version, new Medi never tells old Medi that she's going to grow up to be her, because it would be too devastating to her. I don't think that she would like me.
But that, you've hit on something, actually. I think that many, many, many really wonderful, true-believing Mormon people have questions. And they walk up to the precipice.
Yeah.
And they stick their toe over just a little tiny bit, and they look over and they can smell the wind, they can hear the breeze, and they can maybe just peer over the edge just a little tiny bit. And what they smell and what they hear and what they see scares them.
Yes.
And they step back and they retreat.
And I have compassion for that. Of course they do.
Mm-hmm. We were there.
I stepped back so many times over that 15-year period, over and over again. I retreated because it was too awful to jump over. I had just too much to lose, until something happened in November of last year where I just realized, I can't do it anymore.
What was that thing?
I don't know. it was just such a relief to me to realize, oh, it costs too much now. Something happened. Just, it might have just been like a feather that just changed the scale, so that it was just too much anymore. It hurt too much.
You say the costs are too great. Describe the costs.
Well, I mean, at the time, I was a Sunbeam teacher. I was balancing the joy that I felt in teaching these little kids. I mean, I felt like my Sunbeams would come to my class. They loved church. I had many parents come up to me and tell me, what is it that you are doing? Because my kid tells me all the time that they love Sister Harrison and they want to go to church right now, like in the regular week. And I would just be like, you know, here's the thing. They come into my class. We have 10 minutes where they just tell me about their lives. Little three-year-olds love to chatter about what's going on at home. Then I give them a two-minute lesson. And then we'd go out and go on a walk around the church. And if we'd had a lesson on eyes, we'd look at all the things that we could see. If we had the lesson on, you know, hearing, we'd sit down and listen to the sounds of birds or something. And they always liked to walk on this certain section of the wall. And I'd hold their hands as they walked on this little balance beam. And then we'd go back into church and I played a matching game with them on the floor. I didn't care if they sat on chairs. I don't know. It was glorious. Anyway, that was the wonderful thing.
It was mindfulness for Sunbeams.
Great. It was right at their age level.
But you were teaching them mindfulness and the connection with themselves.
Well, I think I was also teaching them love. I was just teaching them that. I hope that was what I was doing for them, was I was telling to them every minute, I love you. I love you so much. I love exactly who you are right now. You don't need to change a thing about you.
Okay, and you do kind of look like Fred Rogers.
And I feel like that's what God, I feel that God tells me now. Mormonism was exhausting in some ways because it felt like this constant attempt to improve yourself, like you have to perfect yourself all the time. And when I was younger, I loved that. I loved this idea I was going to perfect myself. Check, 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 check. I was very good at that sort of thing.
It didn't seem like a treadmill that was endless.
It didn't. It didn't.
To me, it did.
And I don't know what happened and why that changed for me. But at a certain point, I realized it's been so restful to have these experiences with God where I feel like God, she says to me instead, who are you? Like, just investigate who you are. You don't need to like worry about like shoving parts out of the way and like changing you. Just be you, and like God wants me to unfold in like a blossom and to go from the bud to, you know, all of the stages, and then to be reborn again the next year and to just keep going through that and just allow myself to be who I am, instead of what I feel like I was doing for so long was you're hiding yourself. You're this iceberg and most of you is underneath, and you have all these parts of yourself that are actually making you do things that you don't even understand why you're doing them, because you're so busy building this tip of the iceberg that you want to be shiny and perfect, that instead of like acknowledging who you actually are. And that's why I find it so restful now to sit with God, because God doesn't care who I am. I mean, sorry, God doesn't care about me becoming something other than what I already am. God is just like, who are you? Like, oh, that's interesting. What do you think about that? So I tried to do that.
God makes a hell of a therapist.
Yeah, maybe God's a good therapist. So that was the great part about that. And like I said, I taught nursery for 6 years. A couple of the things that kicked me out. So when the new policy came out, when it first came out in 2015, I started going to church wearing black every day because I was in mourning and I would wear a rainbow ribbon. I felt, maybe ostracized is too strong of a word, but I felt like people were afraid of me. And they kept a little bit of a distance from me. And
they were already doing that.
Yes, they were already doing
that. So
it got further. A little bit worse. Okay. Then I had this experience. So I was still visiting teaching, and they called it visiting teaching at the time that this event happened. But I went to a visiting teaching appointment, and my companion got out the ensign, which she'd not read the article about visiting teaching before. She said she felt inspired that she was supposed to read it, but she had not read it before. She just read it verbatim in this session. And it was about marriage and how important it was that there's marriage only between one man and one woman, which I find kind of hilarious considering the history of Mormonism. But that aside, I felt in that space that I had to speak up and I had to say that the exclusion policy was wrong, that it was not of God, and that it was harming people.
And you were the one visiting your visiting teaching family.
Yes.
Presenting the lesson.
Supposedly. So the woman that we were visiting had, has, that she knows of, a gay nephew. And I say knows of because I suspect that many Mormons have family members who do not talk about their sexuality or their gender to family members because of how dangerous it is.
I know. Yeah. That's true.
So she knows that she has a gay nephew. And she said, well, I'm sure it's going to be really hard for him to be celibate for the rest of his life. But that prophet, we know that the prophet tells us exactly what, you know, God wants us to do. So he'll just have to do that. And I just couldn't let that go. And I can't wish that I had walked out. Although that would have been easier than what happened. What happened was I said to her, you better be very careful. And how would you feel if your nephew killed himself? And unfortunately, the response I got was, well, that's not my fault.
Oh, my gosh.
And it just got worse and worse. And finally, I just buttoned my lip because we were there for an hour and a half.
That's a long visit.
It was a long appointment. And they were just... my companion and the woman I was talking to, who, by the way, were the two dearest friends I had in the ward. They had done so much for me. They were the people that I would have considered my best allies, the people that I trusted the most with my soul. And I don't think I would have bothered with this if that hadn't been the foundation of this setting. And one of them said to me, you can't be Mormon if you believe that. And like my other previous friend who had posted on Huffington, you're not Mormon anymore. It broke me. And we walked out, and she started chattering on about our next appointment. And I finally had to just let her finish what she was saying, and there was a long pause, and I took a deep breath, and I said, I will not be visiting teaching again with you. I will be calling the Release Society president and asking to be released. I do not know if I will ever be able to attend church again, but I cannot go through what just happened again. So I contacted the Release Society president, and I was a little sad. She wasn't one of my dearest friends, but she was somebody I knew pretty well and who I had done some favors for. She never asked me why. She never wanted to talk to me about it. It was never spoken of again. And I continued to attend and I continued to teach the Sunbeams, but every week, even in the primary sharing time, things would come up and I felt like there was leader worship going on, and it turned my stomach, and I started singing different words to primary songs.
Did you write these down?
They're not super complicated. They were just things like whenever we sang, I'm a child of God, to me, I would say they.
Oh, perfect.
Thank you. None of these were things that really I thought would get in trouble. They might annoy people, but ultimately, I didn't think I was going to get excommunicated.
But can't we do like a Mehdi Harrison children's songbook?
No, nobody bothered me about this. This was about me.
But what
realizing.
I'm saying is this is a brilliant, wonderful idea that we can reclaim back those hymns, those children's songs.
No, that's true.
On our own terms.
Yeah.
But shouldn't we all kind of do that? That's my point. With this new idea about who we are.
If I were going to invent my version of Mormonism, like the Mormonism I love.
Tell me.
Definitely invites everybody to do that. Isn't that, to me, one of the foundations of Mormonism is a boy had a question and God answered his question. God appeared to him in vision. But the Mormonism of today is, no. Nobody sees visions. Your God, whatever your God is, no. It has to be whatever, you know, this... their high person that you can never speak to and never criticize, that person knows who God is and you don't. You like whatever vision you have is definitely not God. I wish that we had this other, and I'm not going to create my own church. I'm not interested in anything like that, but I kind of thought that's what Mormonism was.
So here's my thought about this exact thing. I would like to tear apart the hymn book and pick out doctrinal points from only the hymns and have that be Mormonism.
Oh, well, that would be interesting.
If there are points of doctrine that are only found in the hymn book, that's the Mormonism I kind of want to believe in. Except praise of the man. I got a problem with that. I really want to reclaim that for Scotland and for Scots everywhere.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. Well, to me, now, the biggest problem I have with Mormonism is...
Oh, okay. So that's my next question. Where's Mormonism going? And where's Medi going?
I don't know where Mormonism is going. I mean, I have some things of like where I would like it to go. I actually have an essay called The Future of Mormonism where I think the Mormon Church will change because it has to change in order to continue to be alive. But what I see now that I cannot live with is the idea that other people speak to God for me and tell me what God says. I've heard people say that's spiritual abuse. I don't know what it is. I don't need to give it a label. But I'm just going to tell you that I speak to God just fine for me. And God speaks, like, I hear God. And I don't need other people to tell me who God is or what they are saying to me. And anytime somebody does that, it feels like they are stamping on my spirituality. And I can't go back to a space that does that, stamps on me.
So I talk about this a lot, actually, that I don't believe that there should be an intercessor between the individual and deity.
I don't even know that that's Mormon doctrine, but it's the way the church operates now. Which is why I keep saying, I feel like the tagline that I started with, like, I love Mormonism, but I don't believe in the church. That's why I feel like I keep saying that over it. It rings so true to my current experience about Mormonism that I just love so many things, but I can't do that.
So you're able to carve a space where the church is separate from Mormonism. Yes.
The structure, the corporate, part of the church. And also, I get to play with my idea of what Mormonism is. And so for me, playing with that also means that God might be queer.
God is queer. He made the platypus.
I wrote an essay called 13 Ways to Protest the New Policy when the policy came out in November 2015. And so I had this experience when the policy was rescinded where I realized, wait, that didn't fix anything for me. Right. And so I was poking around in myself trying to figure out why that is. And the reason is that I changed. When the policy first came out, all I saw was, this is terrible. This excludes people. But what happened as I continued to like make so many friends in the queer ex-Mormon Mormon community was that I saw how flawed, maybe flawed's the wrong word, how small our theology is, that we only have this one model of how to be, divine. And what I realized is that my lived experience has been that the queer people who I have met and have been so good to me and have taught me so much, that they have to be part of heaven, and that Mormonism desperately needs those people to be in leadership positions so that they can teach all of Mormonism, the things that I have learned about, just expanded my view of family and love and the divine. And until that happens, and we're still, it feels to me like we've gone further back. I know we haven't really. It's just because I've moved into a different space. But just rescinding the policy to me now feels like, guys, you're really not getting it. It's not about whether they're excommunicated or not. I really hope that it helps some people. But the reality is that queer people who live in Mormonism are still being held, still being shown, here's how God looks. God is a heterosexual, cisgender, white male, and Jesus looks exactly like him. So where are women in that? I mean, we don't have images of Heavenly Mother, if that's part of our theology. I mean, people almost never speak about her, especially by herself. It's always just like parents. So she's always subservient in some way to this this God.
Or joined to.
Or joined to, yeah. It's just, it's, again, it's small. It's too small. That's not the God that I experience now.
Yeah, suddenly like the 100, 200, 300 gods in India, that seems really awesome to me now.
Yeah, maybe.
Instead of just one God?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. At least the different aspects of God, isn't it? Yeah, useful to
tease out.
Yeah. And also to see that in ourselves. That to me is just, if you cannot see, if God is not like you in any way, then how can you see the God in yourself? And Mormonism is supposed to be all about, I'm a child of God and I have this capacity for the divine within me. Whatever that means, I don't know that we'll all have planets or whatever. I don't even believe in an afterlife right now. But I do believe in something divine in every person that we meet. And I also believe that, this is a new thing that I've just started to poke around at. We have this narrative within, it's not just Mormonism, but within Western American myths of the hero. And the hero does not exist without the villain. And I think there's a problem in the way that we conceive of the world in terms of heroes and villains. And part of that is our problem with seeing the divine in everyone. Because we don't see the divine in everyone. We like to have little categories of people who are like us. And we see the divine in them, and the people that are not like us are the bad people. And that operates in our politics and in on every level of our culture. And I think it's, and I'm not trying to say like, I don't have that problem. Other people, I have that problem. And I'm trying to examine my own stories that I tell as a storyteller and look at them and think, am I perpetuating this problem of good and evil? Because I actually think that's bad. I think that if there is such a thing as bad, I think it's, okay, it's limited. And maybe causing more harm to our society than good.
So you, I'm almost certain you're familiar with the word namaste.
Yes.
How do you translate that word?
Peace.
Okay. There are many alternate translations of namaste. But the one that I like, that I talk about, speaks very directly to what you've just been talking about for the past few minutes. The divine that is within me sees and recognizes the divine that's contained within you. We recognize deity in each other. That's the translation of namaste that I particularly like.
Yeah. I think Jodi England Hansen also suggested that to me at one point.
She stole it from me.
Oh, she stole it from you.
And I stole it from Buddha. Tell me where you're going.
I don't know. And I feel like that's the great place that I'm in. I feel like Old Mehdi had, she was so ambitious, and I love that about her. It was hard and exhausting to be her.
So you're on Mehdi version 2.0, 3.0?
Yeah, I would probably say 2.0. And one of the things that I love is that I have come to the space where I acknowledge in 20 years I might be another completely different person
I would hope
than
that
I
we
am
all
right
are.
Now. Well, I'm not going to hope that because I hate change, but but I acknowledge that it's probably going to happen whether I like it or not. And I feel like I'm in the space now where I don't have answers. I just ask interesting questions. And
I kind of want to end with a question.
Okay.
There are lots of unknowns, lots of mysteries. You write about many mysteries. Mm. We're surrounded by these things all the time, these things that are unknowable, things we may want to know. Within your life, within your sphere of understanding and education and religiosity, whatever it is now, your cosmology, what's the mystery that you hope you are never able to answer?
Never able to answer. I don't know, maybe it's, am I good enough?
What does that afford you if you're not good enough? If you can't solve that, does that serve you?
Well, I just think that that was a question that I asked for a long, long time. And now I reject the premise of that. I hope that the universe is not a universe in which that is the way that God sees us as good enough or not good enough, but rather that we live in a world in which we just are who we are.
And I want to tease out that answer, and I want to speak, or at least I'm hearing it in a slightly different framework. Am I good enough? Mm. Speaks to complacency. Mm. And this idea that I don't think that you would ever settle for complacency. And you are always trying to improve yourself in some way. I don't think this has to be a negative thing at all.
People don't hear the message that they need to hear, if that makes sense. Like, when I'm talking to a group of writers and I say something like, what you need to do is work on your self-confidence, the people who hear that are the people who shouldn't hear it, and the people who don't hear it are the people who need to hear it. Does that make any sense? So I feel like you are right in saying that complacency is probably not one of my problems. And so I don't know if I need to hear the message of you need to work harder because I'm killing myself all the time. It turns out the message I need to hear is, you know, you are loved. And then I'm going to go on and do whatever I want. When I was in college, I remember having this experience with a professor that I thought really got me. And I would kill myself to work on papers for him. I would write them and rewrite them and rewrite them. And then I had another professor who humiliated me on the first day of class and then took pleasure in humiliating me repeatedly. Pretty quickly, I realized I didn't care what he thought of me anymore. If I feel like God is the first professor, the one who I want to impress, who loves me and who, then I'll just keep working. So I don't need to work on the component of working hard. I need to work on this other component. But that doesn't mean other people need, you know, other people may need to hear another message. But I am busy working on understanding who I am, accepting who I am, and not judging myself or other people. And what I have found is I can't love other people until I love myself. And I can't stop judging other people until I stop doing it to myself. And so I feel like all of the action is going to be useless until I get that basis right. And I don't know that that's true for everybody, but it feels like it's true for me. And maybe I would just recommend other people, you might investigate your attempts to do things may have a faulty foundation in which you have this hero narrative, for instance. And if your hero narrative is then making it so that you're going to push other people down, like you see this with allies all the time. They have this hero narrative that they're saving people, and so they muffle voices of the very people they're supposed to be saving. They're trying to do good work, but they're not investigating themselves. They're not acknowledging who they really are. And so saying that you need to do work without understanding who you are can often be really fraught.
Oh, and my thing, literally since December, has been the more control I can give away, the more control I can relinquish,
see,
the more magic is falling into my lap.
This is what I'm saying about you have to understand who you are before you do the action stuff, because otherwise stuff is going to come out that you can't control, that you don't understand. And it's not about controlling more. It's just about understanding yourself so that your actions, you know, make sense and are not going off in directions that you do not get.
Let's end here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a good conversation.
Thank you.